Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plotkin coming at you live. It's our weekly book club class. We're doing The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Volume 1, by Rabbi Dr. Aaron Rakefet Rothkopf. So let's get right to it. We're on page 135. And the section is called Lithuanian Lore, L-O-R-E, Lithuanian Stories and Traditions and Customs and so on. All about the Litvox. Here's a little piece called Learning by Moonlight. This was related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his annual Yahrzeit Shiur in memory of his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, and it was dated January 1970. He delivered it in Yiddish. Quote, my father told me that there was a tradition in Volozhin that when the author of the Shagas Aryeh, was Rabbi Aryeh Leib Gunzburg, born in 1695 and passed in 1785, the Shagas Aryeh was the rabbi of Volozhin, and he had no money. Very famous rabbi, brilliant man. He earned all of 65 kopecks a week. That was about 32.5 cents in American money at that time. When his request for a modest raise was refused, Rabbi Aryeh Leib Gunzburg, the Shagas Aryeh, left Volozhin, and he became the rabbi of Metz. While in Volozhin, top page 136, while in Volozhin, he studied at night by the light of the moon. He simply could not afford candles or oil. The Shagas Aryeh's situation was exactly like that of Rav and Abaya. Talmud relates that they recited the blessing for the light on Saturday night over their neighbor's flames. Rav said the blessing over the light in the house of Guria ben Chama. Abaya said it over the light in the house of Bar Abuah. Gemara in Brachos 53b. Rav and Abaya had to stand next to the windows on Motzei Shabbos and wait for their wealthy neighbors to light their fires. Rav and Abaya were too poor to afford their own light. The same was true of the Shagas Aryeh. Of course, the footnote says, the situation apparently changed after they became Rashi Yeshiva. Compare the Gemara Chagiga, where Rav complained about having to bribe the royal court in order to stay in the king's good graces. Okay, so he obviously came onto some money. All right, we continue. Rabbinical poverty, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his lecture at the YU Rabbinic Alumni Midwinter Conference in 1955, also in Yiddish. Same idea, but this, he's going to add something over here. Said Rabbi Soloveitchik to the YU Rabbinic Alumni, one thing is certain. You certainly earn more in your rabbinical post than Rabbi Aryeh Leib Gunzburg, the author of the Shagas Aryeh, more than he earned as the rabbi of Volozhin. He received 65 kopecks a week. His request for a weekly raise of 10 kopecks was refused by the community's leaders. In Volozhin, he was so poor, they did not know what coffee and sugar were. When elected to the larger rabbinate of Metz, which was a French and more modern city, he held a Kabbalist Panim, a reception for the laity during his first Shabbos there. His congregants sent a gift of coffee and sugar to his home before Shabbos. At the reception, many of the guests noticed their coffee was bitter. His Rebbetzin did not know how to serve the coffee. Only after it was finished did she serve the sugar. It's so funny. I mean, we laugh, but if you have no familiarity with coffee and sugar, you don't know how to do it. Okay. Enough with the fun. Serious stuff over here. Vilna's Righteous Convert. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his lecture on the Saturday night before the first Slichus in Boston, September 1968. I once heard the following story from my father. It was most probably a true story, since the stories that were transmitted in our family from generation to generation are mostly true. They are not like Hasidic stories, where miracles happen. Laughter from the audience. These stories, which have been told and passed down from generation to generation, are usually true. These stories do not deal with miracles, but with natural phenomena. I do not know whether everybody here knows or has heard of the famous Ger Tzedek, the righteous convert in Vilna. The Ger Tzedek was the son of the famous Polish Count Potocki. His father was one of the leading aristocrats of Poland. Almost half of Lithuania belonged to Potocki, who served in most ways as a feudal lord. He was basically a feudal lord. As you know, feudalism prevailed in Poland until the end of the 18th century. His son is known in Jewish history as Graf, or Count Potocki. Somehow he converted and became a Jew. I was at his grave in Vilna. Now the communists have destroyed his grave. Graf Potocki was sent to one of the famous universities in Italy. It was customary for the Polish aristocracy to send their children to Italy for advanced studies. Thank you so much. Apparently, he became acquainted with Jews there. We do not know exactly what happened. It is clear, however, that he abandoned Catholicism and embraced Judaism. And he became a pious Jew. Because conversion to Judaism was prohibited in Italy, he went to Holland, which permitted such changes of religion. Indeed, had he remained in Holland, he might have lived longer. The Graf, it seems, became lonely and wanted to return to Lithuania. And so he came to Vilna. However, he was afraid to remain in Vilna, where he might be recognized. In Poland at that time, and Lithuania was then part of Poland, conversion to Judaism was considered a capital crime. To avoid the police, he traveled to a small town called Ilya, near Vilna, where he studied. The local Jews discovered that this young man, who sat in the Beit Midrash all day, studying and leading a saintly life, had not been born a Jew. He was a convert and a son of the famous aristocratic Potocki family. Top page 138. I do know exactly what happened. It seems that once a boy was making noise, and the Graf told the youngster to be quiet. The boy's father, a shoemaker, reprimanded the Graf. "You're not a Jew, and yet you told my son to be quiet." Finally, the father of the boy informed the police. That was all that was necessary. As a matter of fact, my uncle told me that there was a certain family in Ilya, which was called the family of the Mostrim, informers. Their ancestor informed the police about Graf Potocki. They arrested him, and, of course, they offered him his life if he would renounce Judaism and return to Catholicism. He would then be restored to his former glory. The Graf resisted all pressure and insisted on remaining a Jew. In spite of his high birth, he was sentenced to death and was executed on the second day of Shavuos in 1749 in the Cathedral Square in front of the famous cathedral in Vilna. After his execution, his body was cremated. Jews disguised as Poles came and collected as much as they could of the ashes. They then buried the ashes. This story is an historical fact. In addition, I heard the following additional detail from my father, who heard it from Reb Chaim, who had in turn heard it from Reb Yosef Baer, who had heard it related in the name of Reb Chaim Volozhiner, the student of the Vilna Gaon. The night before the execution, the Vilna Gaon visited with the Ger Tzedek. Remember, the Vilna Gaon at this point is 29 years old, but he is long ago recognized as a rocket ship meteor of Torah knowledge. And the Vilna Gaon, a young man of 29, visits with the Ger Tzedek. The Graf began to cry. The Vilna Gaon asked him why he was crying. Was he afraid of death and torture? The Ger Tzedek replied that he was only afraid of one thing, that he would be lonely in the world to come. Neither his father nor his family were Jews. As the only Jew in his family, he would be a stranger. Indeed, halachically speaking, he would be completely fatherless. since, quote, one who has become a proselyte is like a child newly born. Gemara in Yevamos 22a. You know very well that the relationship between the father and the son is completely abandoned when one becomes a convert. Indeed, since the Graf was still single when he was executed, he would have no immediate family whatsoever. Top 139. The Vilna Gaon quoted the verse in Isaiah 44, verse 6. Thus says God, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Almighty of hosts, I am the first, and I am the last. And beside me, there is no God. The Gaon then cited the Midrash that says, I am the first, because I do not have a father. I am the last, because I do not have a brother. Beside me there is no God, because I do not have a son. That's Shmos Rabbah 29, subsection 4. To go and question the meaning of this Midrash, what does it mean that God says, I have no father? If this text is correct, it is simply against Christianity. It stresses that God does not have a son. The Vilna Gaon told the count that there was in fact a mistake in the text. The correct reading should be, quote, I am the first to the one who has no father. And I am the last to the one who has no son. Meaning, I am a father to everyone who has no father. To everyone who is lonely. I am a son to everyone who dies childless. This is the promise of the Almighty. The righteous convert exclaimed to the Vilna Gaon, you have comforted me. Only then did the Vilna Gaon leave the prison. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, I always remind myself of the story when I recite this verse in the Malchios kingship prayers on Rosh Hashanah. Super powerful stuff. Top page 140. Despondent on a festival. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his annual Yahrzeit Shir, in memory of his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, held at Yeshiva University, January 1970, in Yiddish. Rav Chaim Volozhiner, born in 1749, passed in 1821, told the following story about his mentor, the Vilna Gaon. A member of Chaim was not a Hasidic Rebbe, and yet he told this story. Once, as a student, he noticed that the Gaon was quite despondent on a festival. This was unlike the Gaon's usual festival demeanor, when he radiated splendor and joy. You know how Reb Chaim trembled in the presence of his Rebbe, and he was wondering whether or not to ask his Rebbe what was bothering him. Finally, Reb Chaim decided that he must ask his Rebbe why his festival joy seemed impaired. The Vilna Gaon responded that during the night, the first night of Pesach, many new Torah insights and secrets had been revealed to him. When he awakened, overwhelmed by the brilliance of these thoughts, he had continued to ponder and meditate upon them. Since he had not yet recited the blessings upon the study of Torah for the new day, these meditations were premature in accordance with his own view on the prohibition of even pondering Torah thoughts without first having recited the Birkos HaTorah, the blessing that you say on the Torah in the morning. As punishment, he forgot all these new Torah insights and was correspondingly depressed. Later, Reb Chaim asked his Rebbe if the new insights had returned to him. The Gaon answered, yes, they all came back. All the new insights and understandings were once again his. This is a real story. It's not a Hasidic story, but rather a Misnagdish one, meaning, of course, the opponents of a Hasidic. Here, too, there are miracles. However, these miracles are different from the ones in the Hasidic stories. Here, in Misnagdish narratives, the miracles center around the knowledge of Torah. Okay. The semicircle around the Gaon, related by Rabbi Menachem Ginak, walking with Ramban, Tradition Magazine, Volume 30, Summer 1996. Once in a shir, the Rav was discussing the halacha that the Sanhedrin sat in a semicircle around the Nasi, around the head of the Sanhedrin. That's on Maimonides' rules in Mishnah Torah, Hilchos Sanhedrin, chapter 1. The Rav pointed out that the equivalent halacha is to be found in the laws of Talmud Torah. Students must sit before their teacher in a semicircle. From a Soloveitchik, this is a general law in the form of communication of Torah. It should be communicated in a fashion where the teacher and the student are visible to each other, so as to be able to engage in a dialogue. To illustrate this point, Rabbi Soloveitchik recalled that when he was a youth in Chaslovichi, the secretary of the Beis Din, who was a very old man, recounted to the young Yosef Dov that he recalled, as a boy, having seen a very old cantor who, when he was a child, had been a member of an itinerant choir that would go from town to town. The cantor had himself recalled that once, when this choir was in Vilna to perform, he had seen a very imposing man, tall and handsome, walking in the street, surrounded by his disciples in a semicircle. When he inquired who this imposing man was, he was told that he was the Chassid of Vilna. In his lifetime, the Vilna Gaon, because of his pious ways, was called the Chassid. When he asked why his disciples surrounded him in a semicircle, he was told that it resembled the Sanhedrin. Yeah, when he was asked. This story made a powerful impression on me. For Soloveitchik had met a man who had met another man who had seen the Vilna Gaon. And imagine if I would have met Rabbi Soloveitchik, I'd be able to say, I saw a man who met a man who himself met another man, and that final man had seen the Vilna Gaon. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, I felt the link between the generations, the confluence of the mighty streams of the Masorah, not only the immediacy, but the intimacy of the relationship between the generations of the tradition, the dialogue that transcends time. The Rav was the Rambam of our generation. He walked with the Rishonim, and many of the students were fortunate enough to walk with him. A Vilna Gaon's wife, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik during a shir at Congregation Moria in New York City, May 1975, in Yiddish. It is told that when the Vilna Gaon eulogized his wife, he claimed that she had suffered much more than he. They had both endured hunger many times because of their poverty. However, She had also been very cold because there had been no fuel to heat their home. He had studied in the community-based medrash, where at least there had been heat. The Gaon added that his study of the Torah had warmed him. His wife had not studied Torah, yet she had possessed so much devotion to the Torah. Well, I'm not going to weigh in on the on any aspect of that. The Vilna Gaon went to study Torah in the community-based medrash, where there had been heat, but there was precious little heat in their house. I'm not sure what to say to that. I won't say anything. I'm coming off of Shabbos about Shalom Bias. I just don't know. I mean, I don't know what to say. Debate in silence is fascinating. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik on Tisha B'Av in Boston, August 1978. This is a Kina elegy, or we say many Kinos on Tisha B'Av, these poems. So one Kina describes the righteous scholars as, quote, great champions in Mishnah and in Talmud. The Hebrew term is Baalei Teresin, which means that they utilize shields to protect themselves from arrows. It is like the shields that the knights used in the Middle Ages. When two rabbinical scholars argue, they reject each other's arguments like the shields which deflected the arrows. Top 143. They tell a story, but I do not believe the story is true. They say that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter once visited with Rabbi Abele Passweiler in Vilna. The latter, Rabbi Passweiler, was conversant with the whole of rabbinic literature, and his erudition was amazing. They greeted each other, and then Rabbi Abele took Rabbi Yisrael by the hand and sat him down. Rabbi Abele took out a Gemara Sota and showed him a line in it. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter opened another Gemara and showed Rabbi Abele a certain line. Then Rabbi Abele opened up a Gemara Shavuos and showed him a certain line. Then Rabbi Yisrael pointed to another Gemara. Not a single word was said. They were engaged in a struggle over the proper understanding of the oral tradition. They just referred each other to the printed lines without explicating and talking. They did not have to explain their importance. They did not have to explain the importance or the relevance of the sources to the issues under consideration. This is the meaning of Baalei Teresin. You will try to attack him, and he will reject the attack with the Gemara which is in his shield. He will open up the Gemara and show you a line in the Gemara or the Tosfos. You will no longer be able to argue after this proof. Baalei Teresin means that you do not need verbal arguments. Even silently, you can debate a halachic topic or a Torah concept. Whether the story is true or not, I do not know. However, it is a nice story. These are the Baalei Teresin. They have shields, and they try to prevent anything from passing. Okay. One more little story. Honoring the deceased. Later by Rabbi Soloveitchik, in his annual Yahrzeit chair in memory of his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, held at Yeshiva University, January 1956. Hebrew, and here you go. Rabbi Chaim Berlin told the following story. In the year 1862, a biography of Rabbi Akiva Eger of Posen appeared. Rabbi Berlin's father, the Nitziv, the famous Nitziv, Rabbi Naftali Tziyuda Berlin, who was himself Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin for years. Rabbi Berlin's father Reb Herschel Leib, known as the Nasiv, refused to even look at the new volume. Let me quote to you word for word the explanation that Reb Chaim Berlin gave to explain his father's actions. Quote, this is because of our sages' dictate regarding the deceased. Quote, there is no need to build monuments for the departed righteous because their teachings are their true remembrances. That's how it has to be. Gracious Rabbah 82. No need to build monuments for the departed righteous. Their teachings are the most true remembrance. It's not important for us to know the dates of their birth and death or to look at their portraits. The proper way to honor their memories is by studying and observing their Torah teachings. This paradoxical approach is uniquely Jewish. Sorry. And it flows from the depths of our ethical understanding. Yeah, I wrote a little note over here that academics acknowledge that generally Jews were just not into recording their history. However, of course, you must understand that Yeshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Beis, Menachem Aleph, and Beis, they do have a tremendous amount of history. Absolutely tremendous amount of history. But still, the academics feel that the Jewish people, for the most part, did not really, really care all that much about, historical events and who was in touch, who was in charge, and things like that. They just, even though we have a Tanakh and apocryphal works and oral tradition, still in all, not really into writing history. This paradoxical approach is uniquely Jewish, and it follows from the depths of our ethical understanding. Okay, 145. It's the page number, not the time. Page 145. Chassidism. Learning how to pray. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his lecture on Parshas Chayesara to the YU Rabbinic alumni, November 1973. 30 years ago. No. What am I saying? Almost 50 years ago, 1973 to 2023, 50 years ago. The Jewish people discovered prayer. We have taught the world how to pray. And yet, we ourselves have forgotten how to pray. There is a true story about Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the founder of Chabad Hasidism, and the author of the Talmud. I'm sorry. He is actually the author of a Tanya. He's famously the author of the Tanya, all about a Brisa. So whenever you see the word Tanya, you think Brisa. So he wrote the book Tanya. They call him the Baal HaTanya, the one in charge of or the owner of the Tanya. When he was a young boy, Shneur Zalman, he was a searcher and an explorer by nature. He was very dissatisfied with the limited opportunities and the gloomy surroundings of his little town in White Russia. He then began to inquire about distant communities. He wanted to wander, travel, and quest. Above all, he wanted to wander under the tutelage of great men. Above all, he wanted to study under the tutelage of great men. He later related that he was informed that there were two great centers of Torah study. In one, they mastered Lundus and achieved the ability to truly comprehend rabbinic works. In the other, they simply studied the sitter. They learned how to daven and pray. The author of the Tanya declared, I was already somewhat of a lamdan as a youngster, but I did not comprehend a single word of the sitter. That is why I chose to go to Mezirich instead of Vilna. The latter was the home of the Vilna Gaon. The former was the residence of the Dover, the Maggid of Mezirich, the latter of the three, the leader of the Hasidic movement. Top page 146. Prayer is an art. We have totally forgotten this art. Today is no more than a mechanical performance. True prayer is more than that. It is an attitude, a state of mind, creating a mood and temperament for the worshiper. Okay. It is an attitude, a state of mind, creating a mood and temperament for the worshiper. It's an exciting experience and an adventure. Sadly, I don't really see that in many, many places. I see people who talk a lot. Some are bored out of their minds. Some join in the singing, and if there's a little bit of dancing, they might join that too. But I see a very, very quick davening in places. There's no effort to slow things down. People have to go to work. Rabbi Soloveitchik himself once said, Jews don't want to daven. They want to have davened. They want to know that they got it over with. They did it. They checked that box on today's to-do list. I prayed. Yad Kavana? No. What'd you pray for? I don't remember. You had anything at all in mind? Not clear. What do you think you accomplished? Not a whole lot. Sad. It's a sad reality. I think if we can somehow get people to pray more, that'd be great. Page 146, The Creation of the World. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his essay, Ish Halacha, Halachic Man. The Simcha Hazelig, a disciple and a friend of Reb Chaim, recounted the following incident to me. Once he and Reb Chaim Brisker, visited someone's home in Vilna. While they were waiting for their host to appear, Reb Chaim glanced through some works of Chabad, Hasidism, that were lying on the table. The books apparently discussed the question of God's motivation in creating the world and cited two opinions. Number one, God created the world for the sake of his good, for the sake of his goodness. Number two, he created it for the sake of his grace. Chaim turned to the Simcha Zelig and with utter seriousness he told him, both views are incorrect. Not for the faint, not for the sake of his grace. Let me read again. Without a seriousness, Chaim Volozhiner told his friend of Simcha Zelig, both views are incorrect. The world was created neither for the sake of his goodness, nor for the sake of his grace, but for the sake of his will to do the Ratzon Hashem. I thought that Hashem did create this out of love in order to be able to give of himself in a loving manner to his children. But the Ramachal wrote that. So then that would be, you know, he created for the sake of his goodness. Gotta look up that Ramachal. It all then should continue. Page 147. Do something simple. Here I'm going to have to get a little bit of water. Yeah, it's good. Do something simple. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his eulogy for Rabbi Moshe Dov Ber Rivkin, a congregation Moria in New York, December 1976, in Yiddish. I heard the following from my father in the name of my grandfather, Reb Chaim. As you know, Reb Chaim Brisker was not a chassid. Although he was closer to Hasidic thought than most people would imagine. Excuse me. Reb Chaim stated about a certain Hasidic Rebbe that when he recited a bracha, those listening would cry because of the emotional experience. This was the heart of Hasidus, to teach a Jew how to properly recite a blessing. What do I know about Chabad? I know quite a bit. Since as a child, I had a Malamed, a teacher, who was a Chabad Chassid. Instead of teaching me Gemara, he taught me Chassidus. Even today, I still know sections of the Tanya by heart, especially the Sha'ar HaYichud V'Emunah, dealing with faith and the attributes of the Almighty. It was my father who taught me Gemara and enabled me to master the rabbinic idiom. Nevertheless, if not for my Chabad Malamed, I would today be lacking in an entire dimension of knowledge. Many of my drushos are based upon the knowledge imparted to me by that Malamed. Those who enjoy my drushos owe him a thank you. His name was Baruch Yaakov Reisberg. And I remember that he told me that he was a descendant of the author of the Tanya, the founder of Chabad. I vividly recall how Baruch would teach Tanya. During this period, my father would visit the Chadarim in Chaslavichi on either Thursday or Friday. The Malamed had lookouts who would inform him when the rabbi was on his way. Immediately, the volumes of Tanya would be hidden. The Tanya was a small book, and it was easy to hide. We would quickly take out the large Gemaras and shout as if deeply involved in Talmudic study. Somehow, we always shouted when we studied Gemara. My father would look around and not notice anything out of the ordinary. Type 148. Once, however, when I accompanied my father to a wedding in Brisk, my grandfather of Chaim tested me. Instead of reciting portions of the Perek Meruba, which is the seventh chapter of a Talmudic tractate, of a Kama, which we were supposedly studying, I recited sections of the Tanya by heart. My father and grandfather may have been angry, but I am in debt to the Malamed. His teachings broadened my horizons in Judaism. The Malamed inspired me with his descriptions of the kingship of God and of the spheros, or emanations from the divine presence. The Malamed had studied in the yeshiva in Lubavitch, and his method of speech uplifted and transformed me. At that time, I was too young to truly comprehend many of his teachings. Only later did I understand and appreciate the lessons in their full depth. He taught me how to pray with emotion and ecstasy and gave me an appreciation for the high holidays prayers. I would think of him on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Do something simple, he would say, but do it with emotion and feeling. That is the basic message of Chabad. Do something mundane and simple, but do it with divine inspiration and meaning. That is the general message of Chassidus, and certainly the touchstone of Chabad. I would like to illustrate the influence of Chabad on me by citing another childhood experience. This too happened in the old Hasidic Beis Medrash where the Rav once prayed. There was an alcove in the northern wall where I would find a place on Friday night before the Mincha prayer. Most people congregated at the eastern wall, but something drew me to the northern wall. There was an alcove in the northern wall where I would find a place on Friday night before the Mincha prayer. Most people congregated at the eastern wall, but something drew me to the northern wall. The Hasidim in Chaslavichi were generally very poor. They were peddlers who barely eked out a living, going from door to door and hamlet to hamlet. They came to shul on Friday evening, still dripping water from the mikveh. I observed their intense devotion as they recited Tehillim, running up and down the Beis Medrash. They could not stand still because they were overwhelmed with emotion and inspiration. While observing them, I felt not only that they were reciting Tehillim in preparation for the prayers, but that the redemption was actually happening at that moment. All their weekday tribulations were behind them, and they were entering a world that was entirely good, and indeed, a world that would, that shall be altogether Shabbos with repose in eternal life. As a child, I was convinced that the presence of God rested upon them in their every movement in the Hasidic space matrix. How about that? Do something simple, but do it with emotion and feeling. All right, we'll do one more little piece and call it a day. This is Joseph and his brothers. It goes for a couple pages. So we'll do it, and we'll let it go. Page 149, Joseph and his brothers, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his lecture on the future of Jewish education in America, New York, May 1975. Let me reintroduce myself. My name you know. I am a rabbi and a teacher. I am a poor rabbi and a very good teacher. That I am a good teacher, I can demonstrate. I point to Rabbi Riskin. He was my pupil. I take pride in him. And I actually came here to help him attain the goal about which he has dreamed for a long time. Now I want to ask you a question. Do you want a long lecture or a short one? Before you answer, I want to define that a short one means 2 hours at least. Well, a long one is until dawn. And I got some laughter. By sheer association, I recall an experience from my early youth. Let me give you the background of that experience. I was then about 7 or 8 years old. I attended a cheder in a small town on the border of White Russia and Russia proper. The town was called Khaslovichi. You certainly have never heard of it. My father was the rabbi in the town. I, like every other Jewish boy, attended the cheder. My teacher was not a great scholar, but he was a chassid, a chabadnik, a leader, a follower of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. His expertise in the study and teaching of Talmud was then under a question mark. As a young boy, I too questioned his scholarship. I know now that he was not a great scholar. Nonetheless, I've been grateful to him all my life because he taught me something that no one else taught me. Perhaps there is one exception, my mother. Mainly, he instructed me in how to behold a vision. He did not train my mind, but somehow addressed himself to my soul and my heart. He taught me how a Jew can be imaginative in religious matters. Many people practice Judaism, but do so unimaginatively. He taught me how to practice Judaism, Torah and mitzvahs, in an imaginative way. He showed us how to see a vision and make it come to life. Not many cheder boys knew what a vision was, and certainly not how to make a dream real. He taught me how to live Judaism and not just practice it. The episode I'm about to relate to you took place on a murky winter day in January. I still remember the day. It was cloudy and overcast. It was after the Hanukkah festival. And the Torah portion of the week was Vayigash. With the end of Hanukkah, ended a little bit of serenity and Yom Tov kite that the festival brought into the monotonous life of the town's Jews. As far as the boys from the cheder were concerned, a long, desolate winter lay ahead. It was a period in which we had to get up while it was still dark and return home from the cheder with a lantern in the hand of each boy because nightfall was so early. On that particular day, The whole cheder, all the boys, were in a depressed mood, listless, lazy, and sad. We recited, or I should say, chanted mechanically, the first verses of Parshas Vayigash in a dull monotone. We were simply droning the words in Hebrew and in Yiddish. So we kept on reading mechanically. Then Judah approached him. Vayigash, I love Judah. Then Judah approached him and said to him, my Lord has asked his servants, well, this is Judah speaking to Joseph. My Lord has asked his servants, saying, have you a father or a brother? And we said to my Lord, we have an old father and a young child of his old age. End quote. Permit me to use the interpretation of the Targum Yerushalmi of the words Yelad Zekunim, meaning a talented boy, a talented child, capable, talented, bright child. We have an old father, and we also have a talented little child. The boy, reading mechanically, finished reciting the question, Hayesh lechem av? And the reply, Yesh lanu av zaken v'yelad zekunim katan. Of course, the question was, do you have a father? And the reply in English is, we have an elderly father and a young boy, and a young brother. It was like the apple of his eye. Then something strange happened. The Rebbe, the Melamed, who was half asleep while the boy was droning on the words in Yiddish and Hebrew, rose, jumped to his feet, and with a strange enigmatic gleam in his eye, motioned to the reader to stop. Then the Rebbe turned to me and assisted me. I'm sorry. Then the Rebbe turned to me and addressed me with the Russian word meaning assistant to the rabbi, Podrabin. Whenever he was excited, he used to address me with the title, assistant to the rabbi. There was a tinge of sarcasm and cynicism in his using the term, because this Chabadnik could never forgive me for having been born into the house of Brisk, which represented Misnagdus, which is, of course, opposition to Hasidus, at the highest level. Although I must say that I cannot accept responsibility for this fact, because it was an accident of birth. Then he said to me, what kind of question did Yosef ask his brothers? Hayesh lechem av? Do you have a father? Of course they had a father. Everybody's got a father. The only person who had no father was the first man of creation, Adam. But anybody who was born into this world has a father. Kind of a question was it? I began, Yosef, I tried to answer, but he did not let me. Yosef, I finally said, meant to find out whether the father was still alive. Do you still have a father? Meaning, is he alive or is he dead? If so, the Malamed thundered back at me. He should have phrased the question differently. Ha'or avichem chai? Is your father still alive? If you're saying that the question is, yeah, you know, is he alive, then he should have asked that question. Ha'or avichem chai? Is your father still alive? But he didn't ask that question. He said, do you have a father? Hayesh lechem av? Now, to argue with the teacher was useless. He began to speak. He was no longer addressing the boys. The impression he gave was that he was speaking to some mysterious visitor, a guest who had come into the cheder, into that cold room, and he kept on talking. Joseph did not intend to ask his brothers about Avos Desgalim. I later discovered this was a Chabad term for parenthood, fatherhood, which is open and visible. Instead, he was asking his brothers about Avos Adeskasin, about the mysterious motherhood or fatherhood. Okay? He was asking the brothers instead about Avos Des Kassen about the mysterious fatherhood or parenthood, the hidden and invisible fatherhood. In modern idiom, I would say he meant to express the idea that Joseph was inquiring about existential parenthood, not biological parenthood. Joseph, the Milanid concluded, was anxious to know whether they felt themselves committed to their roots, to their origins. Were they origin conscious? Are you, Joseph asked the brothers, rooted in your father? Do you look upon him the way the branches or the blossoms look upon the roots of the tree? Do you look upon your father as the feeder, as the foundation of your existence? Do you look upon him as the provider and sustainer of your existence? Or are you a band of rootless shepherds who forget their makor, their origin, and travel and wander from place to place, from pasture to pasture? Suddenly he stopped addressing the strange visitor and began to talk to us. Raising his voice, he asked, "Are you modest and humble? Do you admit that the old father represents an old tradition? Do you believe that the father is capable of telling you something new, something exciting, something challenging, something you didn't know before? Or are you insolent, arrogant, and vain, and deny your dependence upon your father, upon your makor, your source? Hayesh lechem av? Do you have a father?" exclaimed the teacher, pointing at my study mate. I had a study mate who was considered a child prodigy in the town. He was the prodigy, and I had the reputation of being slow. His name was Isaac. The Rebbe turned to him and said, "Who knows more? Do you know more because you're well-versed in the Talmud? Or does your father, Jacob the blacksmith, know more, even though he can barely read Hebrew? Are you proud of your father? If a Jew admits to the supremacy of his father, then ipso facto, he admits to the supremacy of the universal father, the ancient creator of the world, who is called Atik Yomen, elderly in days, old in days." That is the experience I had with the teacher. I have never forgotten it. How can you beat that? How can you beat that? How can you add to that? That's a tough act to follow. Hayesh lechem av? Do you have a father? In my life, I never thought of that. In my whole life, up until now, I did not prepare this piece earlier. It's all new to me. I didn't prepare this piece, and it's hitting like a wave, like a shock wave, that Yosef asked them, "Do you have a father?" First of all, he knew that they did. Second of all, they told him that they did. He kept on saying things like, "We have a father. He's an elderly man. We have a father. Let's knock and cannot." So what's the whole point of the question? Do you have a father? What's this? Came in the mail. Thank you so much. Wow. Dibros Moshe came in with a family inscription. Open up in the very front. See the family inscription.
How do you know?
You'll see.
You bought it?
Captain Kitchen Man sent it to us. So, I asked Hashem Av, do you have a father? Do you have a father whom you respect? Do you have a father from whom you derive? Do you have a father that you look to with love and devotion and say, "I come from this man. He knew more than me. He taught me. He had life experiences." Do you have a father? Can you attribute yourself back to your father? Every Jew should. Wow. Read those words again. Do you have a father? Who knows more? Do you know more because you're well-versed in the Talmud? Or does your father, the blacksmith, know more, even though he can barely read Hebrew? Are you proud of your father? If a Jew admits to the supremacy of his father, then ipso facto, he admits to the supremacy of the universal father, the ancient creator of the world, called Atik Yomen, Sarah Soloveitchik. That's the experience I had with my teacher. I have never forgotten it. Wow. Thank you, Rabbi Soloveitchik, for transporting me back to a small little cheder room taught by a Chabad Melamed, a tremendous lesson, an incredible pshat in Hayesh Lachem Av. Do you have a father? That is a question for every Jew. Just like every Jew's got to answer, Hashem Ra'achi Anochi, am I my brother's keeper? Like every Jew's got to answer, Ayeka, where are you? God asked Adam, where are you? Cain asked God, am I my brother's keeper? Joseph asked the brothers, do you have a father? Wow, great stuff. I want to thank everybody for joining me today. I guarantee it a good class. I hope I delivered. Wishing everybody a great day, great rest of the week. Now, tomorrow night, date night for me and my wife, we're kicking over Tanakh Tuesday to Tanakh Thursday. We'll do the class at 7:30 on Thursday night. So please join us Thursday night for more studying of Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. And so the next class will be Talmud 101, Wednesday morning at 10:30. Wishing everybody a great day. Sorry about my scratchy voice and my cough. God said we'll get over it. Have a great day, everybody. Go to Hatzlacha. Thanks for joining. Take care and be well. Bye-bye.